Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu.
You're going to lose your toenail.
Great.
That happened to me once during my first marriage. My husband dropped a dictionary on my foot, one of those subconscious things, rage as very large book.
You were married before?
Oh, yes. I had one of those rehearsal marriages, you know, where you're a feminist and train a guy, and then some other feminist comes along and gets the guy.
I don't know. I think there's something wrong with the words feminist and gets the guy being in the same sentence.
Yes, well.
Were you upset?
Of course. But then I'd been doing everything. I'd insisted on separate finances, on being totally self-supporting. I was working. I was doing the child care. I paid for the house. I cooked. I cleaned. I found myself shouting, "This is feminism. Thank you, Gloria and Betty."
But now you're with someone else.
Pre-taught, self-cleaning, batteries included.
Someone else trained him and you stole him?
Of course. What? Am I crazy?
What happened to the toe?
The nail came off, and the one that grew back was wavy and dark and used to scare the children.
Oh. That's a conversation between two characters in Terrific Mother, a short story by acclaimed writer Laurie Moore. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Year.
Laurie Moore has been called one of the premier authors of her generation, the most irresistible writer now practicing the art of fiction, a fiction powerhouse, America's sexiest writer because of her crackling wit and exacting eye, and a linguistic maestro. She received national attention at age 26 for her witty book Self-Help and widespread praise for later works such as Like Life, Birds of America, Anagrams, Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, and the recent novel A Gate at the Stairs. She is a professor of English and creative writing teacher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and joins us for an hour exploring her work as a writer.
Welcome back to University of the Year. It's been a long time.
Yes, thank you for having me back.
Now, you have resisted the idea, as I suppose many authors have, of this whole kind of autobiographical approach to writing. But how many times has it happened where you've written something just based out on experience? I mean, if you've been in an earthquake, you know, you might write about a character who goes through an earthquake. How many times has it happened that a friend or a family member reading your book says, "Oh, I know where you got that part."
Oh, that has happened. I don't necessarily oppose an autobiographical approach to writing fiction. I just don't like fiction to be confused with autobiography, and that does happen. But, you know, I think we've, in fact, have talked about this before where, you know, once I use someone's dessert plates in a story and they were really shocked to see their dessert plates because nothing else in the story had any relationship to their lives at all, but there were their dessert plates. So that's the, you know, so I will pick and choose and make a collage of things. And often people will find their shoes, will find their ex-boyfriend, you know, they'll find little things, but it doesn't all cohere into anything that ever, you know, happened. That's just the way artists work.
You're saying so essentially so details rather than the arc of a story.
Well, pretty much. There are some stories that have an arc that is similar to something that I have experienced, but very, very few of them. Mostly, I'm interested in experiences I haven't had, but perhaps have heard about or want to imagine or piece together with things that I know a little bit about, but not a lot.
So if you see a story in the newspaper, you think, boy, that is a fantastic plot line. Does that kind of thing attract you at all?
Well, you know, that used to be an assignment in graduate school. I had a teacher who loved to do that. He said, go out and read the paper and write a short story based on some article that interests you. And I've tried that too with my students. I haven't done that a lot, but certainly that's there, that's available. Sometimes it sends you back to your own life or to a couple of lives that you do know that are sort of have some relationship to that newspaper story. And so it sends you thinking about certain things, you know, and then you end up with you know, then you end up again with a collage, with a pastiche.
If you look back at your childhood and growing up in New York and so on, with the parents that you had, the family you had, what was there that sort of pointed the way that you were going to become a writer? I mean, were you like the Bronte sisters, where you had little books and little imaginative things?
No, we weren't like the Bronte sisters. That's a good thing, though.
Yeah. You're much healthier, I'm sure.
And we live longer. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to know where. I guess what you're asking is where does writing come from? And nobody. That's a really difficult thing to say. I mean, I have nieces and nephews who, you know, wrote novels when they were 11, and I haven't read them. I haven't asked to read them either, because novels usually are something that, you know, are, you know, you can't really be a prodigy unless you're, you know, one of the Brontes. So if you start writing seriously and effectively, it's usually happening late in your 20s, you know, late for the arts. And where that comes from is, you know, a whole broth of things, you know, a whole brew of things. And you have to love books, you have to love reading, you have to love stories, you have to love poetry and music, and have some kind of intellectual life where you want to put ideas in motion and dramatize them a little bit. I think I really loved theater a lot, and that was a very early, you know, that got in on the ground floor with me. I still have never been able to write a play, or at least a play that I would show anyone.
Your writing is filled with lots of humor, including a lot of one-liners that just really make me laugh. They can kind of be lifted out and just are like these little gems, like, he was thinking, but she could tell he wasn't good at it. Or, I'm busy, or I'm being earnest, but not in the Hemingway sense. You know, just lots of...
That's terrible, actually.
The vital importance of being.
Or the family that slays together, stays together.
And, oh,
you know, just different
kind of spooky
lines. Yeah. Where would you say that love of wordplay, puns, repartee, the kind of just playfulness with it, which, as suggested with the title of your work, Anagrams, where you know, do a lot of playing with words?
I don't know. I think it just comes from the people I've known my whole life. I mean, my father talks like that all the time. You know, I was just saying to him, because I was teaching at Princeton at this past semester, and I said, you know, Princeton's very Asian. He said, well, I hope it's very Asian on a theme.
Very Asian on a theme.
He's 86.
That's good.
He's 86.
Yeah.
He talks like that all the time. So, you know, it may be a kind of dementia that's just in the air.
Well, there's another aspect to your humor, too, and I don't know. I suppose you kind of summarize these things at your peril, but there's always a sort of undercutting. And for example, your most recent book, things that are designed for one purpose end up getting used for another. Unfortunately, the only example I can think of right now is the two women, young women who are very close friends, and one gets a boyfriend. And she leaves behind a certain device that's designed for, what shall we say, a certain kind of stimulation. And our protagonist, who is left behind without a boyfriend, ends up using it for, what, stirring her hot chocolate or something.
Stirring her hot, chocolate milk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So but there's always this – I mean, I see a lot of this kind of undercutting in your humor. I mean, it certainly works consistently.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, again, some of it's collected from the real world. So, I mean, I do have a friend who made a joke, something like that, but he didn't remember making it, and so I put it in there. And then,
it's fair game.
And then when he saw it, he said, that was so funny. I said, well, guess where I got it from?
You write in one of your stories that irony is something a little alien to the Midwest, that there is something a little bit more Dorothy Parker-like. About a certain kind of wit, a certain kind of biting quality. Do you feel that some of your humor is a kind of New York humor?
I don't like those categories really very much, and I probably did think in those categories a little more when I first came here. I can no longer think in those categories very well because I've been here so long, so I've lost my bearings a little bit. You know, I don't quite know, you know, what constitutes Midwesternness and what constitutes New Yorkness.
You're mostly upstate New Yorkness, though,
although you've spent a lot of time in the city.
Right.
I grew up in upstate New York. So actually my childhood would be, in fact, would have more in common, I think, with the Midwest than with New York City.
Is there a religious sensibility that underlies your work? You write at one point in your recent novel about the Unitarian Church, calling it for people who felt that God should be elected democratically and after a long campaign.
Well, that's just a joke.
I know.
That's a joke we all make about Unitarians, yeah. And that's very common in the Midwest. I did grow up in a kind of Bible-reading family, but it didn't have a strong family history behind it or a community behind it. My parents were just suddenly interested because they themselves were not going to church. They suddenly decided that they should go to church and that they should raise their kids religiously. And somehow it was some kind of exposure to Christianity. So they found a church, and we went to it every Sunday. We read the Bible every single night at our dinner table, which seems, you know, if I say this to my students now, they're like, what?
What book would that be?
Well, and also, what century did you grow up in, and how old are you? We read the New Testament every night at dinner and on Sundays, because dinner was at noon. Sundays in the evening, we read the Old Testament. That was my childhood. So there was Bible reading, but I can't say we absorbed a lot of it. You know, there were four of us, and a lot, you know, we kind of just sat there like that a lot with our arms folded across our chests.
Like the Sunday school experience of a lot of young people. Right, yeah. You're there for the hour. You don't necessarily.
Right, you don't necessarily. Right.
If I had to put a peg or compare your sense of humor in your writing to anyone, the closest I would come right offhand would be James Joyce, actually, with that kind of Irish and constantly, I mean, everything meant to do some one thing, you know, ends up being relegated to some other purpose, and everything is there's so much kind of falling flat of things.
Well, I think that falling flat and that undercutting, that is, you know, the source of comedy in a way. It's also the source of tragedy and disappointment, you know, that things build to a certain tension and then are somehow undercut and unexpected things happen. That can be tragedy, that can be comedy. I mean, there's an overlap yeah. to the mechanics.
Part of that is how you write it, isn't it? I mean, if you're not careful, your tragedy will tip over into comedy. And it's kind of up to you to put the right edge on it.
Joan Rivers has talked a lot about that. You know, she just says there's nothing that happens that isn't potentially funny. She said, I was making 9/11 jokes on 9/12.
Wow, that's a tough assignment.
Yeah. She probably was, and probably no one was laughing. But everything is potentially funny, I guess, if you're speaking of it in a zone of safety. And that's the beauty of a zone of safety, you know, that. And that's the beauty of humor, that it indicates you're in a zone of safety.
Well, and with the blues, where there's sort of laughter to stop the tears, there's that bittersweet mixture that's there all the time.
Right.
If we go back to your earliest collection that got you sort of national attention in your 20s, Self-Help, what can you say about that book, the title of it, the concept of it, and is there a passage you might share from it?
Oh, I haven't looked at this book in so long. It's all I can say is I would never write these stories now. And they all just make me wince.
Now, well, some of that's good. Some of that's a common artistic thing. But why would you not even write them?
Because I wouldn't. I just wouldn't write these particular stories. They wouldn't be what's on my mind now. I mean, I think I also chose what I thought was a kind of experimental form to give life to what were essentially sort of generic stories. I knew at the time that I didn't have any special information to offer the world, and I didn't have any special stories. But I thought you could tell a kind of generic story if you told it interestingly. So I chose this sort of mock imperative And I was very interested in trying to keep the sentences interesting and lyrical. Some of these stories are bad. I'm looking at
them. They won you national acclaim, so they can't have been that bad. Well, they got you on a sort of a level of attention that few writers have in their 20s. Why don't you share just a passage from it so that those who haven't heard it can hear that voice you're talking about, which is this mock self-help book.
Well, here's the one story whose writing I still kind of like. And this was the last story I wrote for this book. And it's called Among the Night Visitors, A Guide to the Tenor of Love. Understand that your cat is a whore and can't help you. She takes on love with the whiskery adjustments of a gold digger. She is a gorgeous nomad, an unfriend. Recall how just last month when you got her from Bob downstairs, after Bob had become suddenly allergic, she leaped into your lap and purred, guttural as a German chanteuse, familiar and furry as a mold. Should I stop there?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. It sounds like poetry to me.
Yeah. I always was very interested in poetry. Thank you for saying that, actually. Yeah, it's, of course it's poetry.
But would you start? Did you write a lot of poetry before you wrote short stories?
I wrote some really bad poems. I wrote really bad poetry, yeah.
Why bad poetry? I mean, if we looked at The New Yorker and saw that in lines that were all broken up, you'd say, oh, that's... You know, that's great poetry.
No, you probably wouldn't. You probably wouldn't. You know, it's, you know, a poem has to have, you know, a complete idea. It has to, you know, again, it's like writing a play. Because you have some interesting dialogue doesn't mean you know how to write a play. Because you are interested in language and the musicality of language doesn't mean you can write a poem. But it means you can, in a short story, you can put elements of theater and elements of poetry in your work. But what you end up with is not a poem and not a play. You end up with a short story, and that's the beauty of the form of a short story, which is not really a form at all. It's a genre, and you can incorporate other forms in it.
It seems to me you also bring in these just moments that we all can recognize as familiar, but we may not have seen them before. And you know, you were reading about a cat in that passage, but I think about the story you wrote in a later collection called Joy, where there's a visit to the veterinarian and this embarrassment that comes when your cat's name is paired with your last name. So we've got Fluffers, Conwicky, and Gooby Miller. And, you know, I happen to have cats with really embarrassing names. And so, you know, I saw that. It's something we can recognize. And then going to the vet is never the same because we've had that moment of insight.
It's very, you know, it's strange how surreal just everyday life is. I mean, that's a really startling thing when you hear your cat suddenly with your last name as if you had gotten married or something.
Or even sometimes pets these days, at least my pets, get mail, like a postcard will come.
Well, and people, of course, have their pets on their answering machines. If you want to leave a message for, you know, Mr. X, Mrs. X, or Spot, you know, then push 3.
There's something wrong with that.
Yeah. I know two or three people who do that.
With them.
Yeah, it seems
what is
a little.
Wrong with
but,
us?
But I have to admit, maybe there's something wrong with me, but I always leave the message for the pet.
Good for you.
But it's that celebrating the absurdity of life and the richness of these little moments that are kind of crazy.
Well, I think writers, you know, go around and collect those, you know, because you just go through the day and weird things occur. And you kind of collect them and you see what these moments both mean and maybe can't mean about, you know, contemporary living.
More on the writing of Lori Moore when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
It was a fear greater than death, according to the magazines. Death was number 4, after mutilation 3 and divorce 2. Number 1, the real fear, the one death could not even approach, was public speaking. Abby Mallon knew this too well, which is why she had liked her job at American Scholastic Tests. She got to work with words in a private way. The speech she made was done in the back, alone, like little shoes cobbled by an elf. Spider is to web as weaver is to blank. That one was hers. She was proud of that. Also, blank is to heartache as forest is to bench.
That's the opening of the story, which is more than I can say about some people. One of the stories included in Birds of America by Lori Moore. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest this hour is Lori Moore. In that story, you write about fear of public speaking, liking to have this sort of private life with words and so on. How have you felt about going out on book tours and having to face people with questions like we're doing to you right now about your books? Do you like talking about your writing, or do you hate it?
Well, no writer likes it. You know, you're obligated to do it because of your publisher and all of that. So, and you end up, ironically, signed up for a public life you were always trying to avoid by becoming a writer. You know, so writers are in shock because they live like hermits, you know, for a couple of years, and then suddenly they're put in front of audiences. It's like, what? You know, it's like bait and switch.
Well, I suppose for some, at least, we're still in that, especially today, you have to be more and more a salesman for your product. And so a lot of writers seems to me are the opposite of that kind of outgoing personality.
They're not those kinds of people. That's why publishers love celebrity bios, because those people are those kinds of people. And, you know, they can go on the talk shows and they can sell books. And so, I mean, that's one of the problems with publishing right now, as it struggles. It has to deal with authors of literary fiction who don't want to go out of the house. No, thank you.
Much like your character there.
Amy Tan said that she realized she was a success when she saw there were cliff notes to a Joy Luck Club. At what point did you realize you'd sort of made it as a writer? Was there a moment?
I never think in those
terms.
You never
feel that way?
No, I don't think in those terms at all. No, I mean, I suppose if you're a composer and you've written your great symphony and written your great opera, then you have a lot of other little smaller things you think you've done it. But no, I'm just getting started. I'm just getting started, I hope.
Well, at least a writer doesn't have to...
I have my symphony and opera ahead.
And a writer doesn't have to stop the way like a dancer or an athlete.
That's right.
They peak so early.
It's not a performative thing. It's a creative thing, so you get to go on for quite some time.
It has to be, I gather, though, sort of, in a way, almost an accidental thing. In other words, you can't say, oh, well, maybe if I take a Caribbean cruise, it'll give me some good ideas for my next story or my next book. It has to be... I'm thinking you take a Caribbean cruise and then something just happens to happen or not that comes across as an idea.
Well, I think it's like what we were saying before, like every day that you walk through life, walk through the store, walk through the world, there's something you notice that's absurd and interesting and you might take notes. Now, on a cruise, no matter how horrible it is. And, you know, David Foster Wallace wrote that famous piece about being on a cruise called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. There's always notes you can be taking, and you can use them later as a backdrop of another story, or you can, I'm a great believer in smushing. That's the collage artist in me, where you would take a story you're interested in writing, say you're interested in updating Washington Square, Henry James's
sure.
Washington Square,
that
where some
like
ne'er-do-well is after some heiress's money. But then you also went on a cruise and you have all these sort of notes.
So you smush them
and you have a story.
With some interesting, odd alignments of things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I haven't done this, but I mean, there's an idea for somebody. Because I hate boats.
You hate boats?
I hate boats, so I can't do that.
That. In a way, that doesn't matter, though, does it? Because that would make a great story. I mean, you probably would hate to kiss the Blarney Stone, too.
Oh, I did that
one. But it makes a great story. You know, sometimes the thing you don't like is what makes the great story. Although you wouldn't necessarily seek it out.
Well, you'd have to know the details of it somehow. So you'd have to quiz someone, or you'd have to get those details for the cruise thing. I don't know. And the details a writer would notice are not necessarily the ones that someone else would notice.
Oh, for sure.
Although there are a lot of people with a great eye for the absurd who don't write things down. So you can interview people and get things, or you can just hear things over dinner. I mean, that's famously how Henry James got all of his ideas, at dinner parties.
Just at dinner parties. Well, speaking of speaking, do you take notes when you overhear? I listened to, many years ago, I talked to Elmore Leonard, and he was talking about where his dialogue comes from. And he'd just like be passing through a mall or something. You hear this little scrap of conversation, and it has so much color in it that he picks up on.
It's astonishing. I mean, just yesterday I was walking down the street, and of course MGE has all these yellow flags because we're about to have our street dug up for the new sewer, you know, lines. And I heard somebody say, you know, two blocks from my house, a younger man was saying to an older man, "I hope they don't think this is where the gas line is, because that is so not where it is."
That's enough. That's a launch pad for a story right there.
So, yeah, and for a scary summer. So you hear things all the time like that.
But do you actually write notes, or you just make mental notes, or you just kind of let it wash through and then see what strikes you later?
I used to madly take notes because I knew that I would forget if I didn't take the notes. And now I sometimes forget to take the notes. But I try to. I try to do
that. Because it is hard to hold on to details that you think you're going to remember.
Right.
With your collection that you were just reading from Birds of America, can you talk about the title of that?
Well, when I was completing the final story or two of this collection, I noticed all the bird imagery. And I thought also that the story I was writing about, since it had an allusion to Audubon, might be a prompt for the title, which is, of course, the title of Audubon's book, famous book, Birds of America.
Have you ever seen it misfiled in a store where you go and find your novel in the...
All my books have been misfiled.
You did a cute thing, though, at one book signing. You actually were reading and signing right in front of a copy of the Audubon. I'm sure somebody did that
deliberately.
Really?
I don't remember that. Oh.
Well, which is a book that shows up because it's got it's a thick book, Birds of America.
It's a beautiful book. But my first book, Self-Help, went right into health and, you know, personal improvement.
Somebody must have had a surprise if they came home from this story.
Well, I thought, I hope this helps sales. Yeah.
And if somebody bought Birds of America and didn't open it up and thought it was going to be a field guide, that would be interesting too.
That's been misfiled, and so there's a lot of disappointed people there. Anagrams was filed in Games and Puzzles. It was. They were all misfiled.
In Birds of America, one of your most famous stories, I think it won a O. Henry Award in 1998, is the story People Like That Are the Only People Here. Can you say something about that story for those who haven't read it and maybe give a passage from that?
This is a story that is about, you know, a parent's worst nightmare, you know, discovering that your baby has a fatal disease. And so I was trying to register the shock and disorientation and you know, kind of the horror of all that. In the end, I mean, it's written in the present tense. I can't even find it in here. It's written in the present tense. And the present tense I always think of as the tense of irresolution, you know, events are suspended.
You also use sort of archetypal names like baby, the father, the radiologist, rather than specific names.
Right. And I did that just to get started writing it. But then I realized that was probably appropriate because there's a kind of script that people fall into in emergency situations. You're just getting up and mechanically going through a drama that is out of your hands. And so I thought, well, this is like a script. So a script would, there are scripts who just say the mother, the father, the baby. And so I kept it like that to emphasize the scriptness of it.
You write that baby and chemotherapy should never appear in the same sentence.
Well, that's true.
Let alone the same life. Is there a passage you can read that gives us that odd voice that's in it, that voice that any parent, I think, can relate to who's gone through a similar situation?
I'll just start on the second page, I guess. In radiology, the baby stands anxiously on the table, naked against the mother as she holds him still against her legs and waist, the radiologist's cold, scanning disc moving about the baby's back. The baby whimpers, looks up at the mother. Let's get out of here, his eyes beg. Pick me up. The radiologist stops, freezes one of the many swirls of oceanic gray, and clicks repeatedly, a single moment within the long, cavernous weather map that is the baby's insides. Are you finding something? Asks the mother. Last year, her Uncle Larry had a kidney removed for something that turned out to be benign. These imaging machines, they are like dogs or metal detectors. They find everything but don't know what they've found. That's where the surgeons come in. They're like the owners of the dogs. Give me that, they say to the dog. What the heck is that? The surgeon will speak to you, says the radiologist. Are you finding something? The surgeon will speak to you, the radiologist says again. There seems to be something there, but the surgeon will talk to you about it. My uncle once had something on his kidney, says the mother. So they removed the kidney, and it turned out the something was benign. The radiologist smiles a broad, ominous smile. That's always the way it is, he says. You don't know exactly what it is until it's in the bucket. In the bucket, the mother repeats. The radiologist's grin grows scarily wider. Is that even possible? That's doctor talk, he says. It's very appealing, says the mother. It's a very appealing way to talk.
Dialogue like that, Lori, still, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm reading that, that still has a kind of a gallows humor to it. I mean, it still cuts both ways.
Yeah, it's got gallows humor. It's got some actual anger, you know. There are places in which the story is, you know, is also expressing the anger of the mother. That's the real mix of things.
But the anger of the mother at the medical profession for sounding a little jaded, or the anger for being in this position
exactly.
In the first place?
Well, there's that. But there's also the medical world lives in this condition of emergency all the time. And so they have to have their own coping mechanisms.
They're kind of distancing. Mm-hmm.
But somebody else who's just a patient coming in with an emergency of a loved one then has to encounter the coping mechanisms of the staff, and it's a weird collision
of sensibilities.
I think that's maybe one reason why calling them the mother and the baby works so well, because when you go into a hospital setting, you feel as if you've lost your own identity and humanity.
Absolutely.
You just become this body on a
right.
examining table.
Right.
If I remember right, and it's been a while since I read the story, but I think the mother also is a writer, and that the husband is wanting her to write something about it so they can make some money. Am I remembering right?
Yeah.
Which is another level of sort of trying to detach from one's own emotions to be able to write about it.
I was interested in having be part of the subject, the problem of writing about such a thing, if one is a writer. I mean, how does one take things from life and then transform them? And if one is professionalized and has to sort of do this on a professional basis, how does that enter the mind? How does that warp the mind? What are the kinds of thoughts one might have?
There's a remarkable instance of that in the life of Mark Twain, who I have started the first 100 or 200 or 300 pages of, you know, the recently published autobiography, Volume 1.
I hear it's very nutty.
Very nutty?
Well, it's very,
it's
organized.
A real pastiche, but mm-hmm. all the writing, almost all of it is really compelling, but it's just mm-hmm. little chunks of things here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And along the line somewhere is the point where when his wife is clearly going to die and he's in the next room writing about it. Whereas for many writers, they would just shut down and it could be years or never that they'd be able to cope with that. But he's literally, you know, writing fairly finished prose as this is unfolding.
I know. There is, you know, there is the detachment of the artist that is troubling to the human part of the artist. I mean, there is something inhuman in making art. You detach a little bit. Alice Munro has written about that. A lot of writers have written about it because it's not something to be proud of. It's just something that is. You know, this is just what you do. And there's a divide in the brain a little bit. But you move back and forth across. And everybody has different lines. You know, not everyone would be doing what Mark Twain did.
But you seem to be saying that in a sense you're using other people when you're a writer.
Well, you're not. I don't. Well, some people would say that. I don't feel that. But I feel that you remove yourself sometimes from the human situation to take note, even in the most compassionate ways, of the storiness of a certain experience. And in order to sort of not lose the details and not lose what's meaningful about that experience, you may have to get it down fairly quickly. I don't know.
Well, that would be the discipline of the journalist, for example, which
right.
Twain certainly
right.
had.
He had that practice as a journalist, as did Hemingway, as did a lot
Yeats.
Of our great writers.
Or Yeats would have put it as a terrible beauty is born, that if you take a war and turn it into a poem, that's a kind of terrible beauty.
Yeah, there are these issues in photography. War photography certainly has these issues. I mean, everybody draws the line different places. And, of course, in your own art, you probably will defend the habits of writers more than you would defend the habits of photographers in war, maybe. I don't know.
In your short story collection, Like Life, there are a lot of sort of failed relationships, terrible dating occurrences. I think there's one where a woman is dating boy number one and boy number two and wishes for a kind of composite boy number three that never emerges. Can you say something about the way you find humor and richness of a material in courtship and relationships, the sort of games people play?
I don't have a lot of those. I mean, I'm interested. I mean, the short story is sort of famous for allowing itself to be about love. And I don't have a lot of love stories, but in, you know, The Jewish Hunter would be one.
You write about how instead some character says,
really
instead
not.
Of having a love life, I have a like life.
Yeah, see, that's what this book is more.
It seems to be kind of true in the novels, too.
Yeah. Well, you have to, you know, things can't work out perfectly or you have no story. So I think I was interested in like life in a lot of urban stories and ways in which people either get displanted emotionally or even geographically out of their urban settings.
I can't remember which story it is. It might be real estate, but I thought there was one where a woman starts to throw a man off the balcony and then says, "Just kidding."
That's my most anthologized story.
Real it's estate? Called,
no,
it's, wrong
it's
one.
Called You're Ugly Too.
Oh, okay.
When
it's
I wrote
a great
it,
title.
Well, it's the punchline of a joke, you know.
I know at least one joke with that is the punchline.
Right, it's the punchline of a joke. And the joke
doctor.
Is, right.
Yeah. It's funny.
Can I get a second opinion? Okay, you're ugly too.
Yeah,
that's the joke. This when I wrote this story, I had such fun, but I thought it was so weird. And I wrote it here in Wisconsin, but I was fresh from spending a long time in New York, and I was trying to get something about New York down. just the craziness of single life a little bit. And I thought, no one will publish this story. It's just too weird. But it was the first story that the New Yorker took. And so I thought, what? And then it got widely anthologized, and then it got put in some prize anthologies. And I thought, I don't like this story anymore. No one's paying attention to my other stories. They just want to talk about this one.
Well, that happens.
I know that happens to story writers all the time. They end up...
And composers.
And composers, right. There's just one thing that people are grabbing onto and everything else seems to fall by the wayside.
Well, you had a gap of quite a few years, kind of a decade before your most recent novel, A Gate at the Stairs, and we're going to talk about that novel when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm forming a support group, said Sarah. Don't laugh. But I wasn't laughing. I'm going to use the very mechanisms of this town against it, this goddamn self-satisfied town that drinks its own bathwater, I said, borrowing a Delacross expression for Troy. It was a metaphor and not a metaphor, and is what the outlying areas of the state all felt, that Troy was a piece of smug, liberal, recycling, civic-minded monkey masturbation, that it was gestural, trying to make itself feel good, which in Delacross meant better than everyone else, that it wasn't real. That was the true crime, its lack of reality, whatever that meant. Also, once a year, some rural girl came to Troy for the weekend, drank too much, and ended up raped and beaten to death in some apartment or park. Sarah looked at me with sudden, searching concentration. It was a look I was coming to know, and it was one I felt inside of me often, a feeling of aghast but childlike scrutiny. It said, "Why are there more space aliens on this planet than there used to be? Or are we the space aliens, and are the human beings, coming back?"
Lori Moore reading from her recent novel, A Gate at the Stairs. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Lori Moore. In A Gate at the Stairs, you are pretty thoroughly Midwestern. Is it safe to say that?
I thought so. And, you know, a friend of mine who used to teach here, who now teaches in Washington, D.C., I saw him last year in D.C. He said, Lori, I read that book and I thought, oh, no, she's become a true Wisconsinite. And I said, well, no one in Wisconsin thinks that.
But maybe it's a good thing because then you can't be pegged. You can't be pigeonholed.
Well, but you get pigeonholed one way or the other. It's all wrong, you know, I guess. But
well,
you know.
There's always a kind of a distancing, you know, the kind of an irony in so much of you write, so in a sense you have to be the outsider to write about it. I mean, even
that's
if you're
right.
from the Midwest,
that's
you
right.
sort of have to
that's right.
have that perspective.
And in some ways I thought I should write, you know, when I started this book I thought I should get everything I think is interesting about Wisconsin into this novel as soon as I can, because soon I will just lose that outsider eye. I just won't see it anymore.
You'll be too immersed.
I'll be too immersed.
What time
was ticking on that one. So
At what point did this become a novel instead of a short story for you?
Oh, it was always...
Always a novel.
It was always a novel, despite what the critics say. I know there's some...
I mean, in the conception process, you thought, I'm
going
to write
a novel
about the Midwest.
Always, right. Because there was a lot of stuff I wanted to put in there.
Well, tell us about your heroine, Tassie, 20 years old, college student, and sort of maybe how she fits into the tradition of the governess novel.
Well, I thought of her as, you know, as a Wisconsin, you know, figure, but who is also has some distancing aspects to her. Her parents are actually not from the area. That she's grown up on this kind of boutique farm. So she doesn't really fit into the farming community. She comes to this town of Troy and finds it very sophisticated and full of the culture she's sort of been hungering for. And she gets a job with another household in town. And so I thought of this as being in the tradition of a kind of nanny novel or governess novel. I thought very much of Jane Eyre and have little allusions to mm-hmm. Jane Eyre throughout, including the very ending, yes. which many people have not even
I love
noticed.
The reader. I did not even have coffee with him.
I thought, if you don't know that's from Jane Eyre, you know, I don't know what that line could possibly mean, but there were a lot of people, and I won't say exactly who, but there were a lot of people who had no idea I was alluding to Jane Eyre there.
You make Tassie half Jewish. You make her father a potato farmer who used to be a college president's son. There's a lot of kind of funny dichotomies with people who are half one thing or another.
Right, right.
What were you sort of aiming at?
Well,
there?
That's sort of how I see this. I mean, it's true to the country as a whole. It's certainly true for Wisconsin that everybody's a mix of things. No one's like fully this or fully that. And that's part of the beauty of this particular century as we move forward. So I thought that was just the truth. So I wanted that down.
Is there a point when you're finished with this novel or finishing it and you're talking to your publisher or agent and you get a question that a lot of entry-level authors would get, so what's the target audience for this book? I mean, you have to get into that kind of marketing when you're even thinking about writing a book?
The thing you have to do, the only I feel, if you're going to continue as a literary writer, they will try. And my editor is very good this way, but she's just one woman in a large company. So there are other people who get their hands on your book. And there are things that go in and out of fashion. And one of the things that's in fashion right now is young adult novels.
Very much so.
And chick lit.
Yes.
So you have to make sure that they don't chick lit your book or YA your book when it's not chick lit and not a YA. So you have to struggle with that.
So what do you say? I mean, if you just say literary fiction, that's
they wring their hands and they burst into tears. But you know, you have to do it. Jeff Dyer was saying, Jeff Dyer, the writer. He said they even chick-lit me.
Well, and there was the business with Jonathan Franzen not wanting his book on Oprah, not wanting to be,
or saying that it wasn't necessarily the best thing for in some cases, yeah.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure how that. I think that was a misunderstood mm-hmm. comment, and it all got way out of hand. But they had their reunion. It all worked out.
I know, but that same feeling of not wanting to have a book labeled as a certain sort of book. One of the parts of A Gate at the Stairs that I really like is the way you look at these Wednesday evening support groups for transracial, biracial, multiracial families, and some of the sort of excruciatingly politically correct liberal chat that's going on. Can you talk about that aspect of the book and the way you wanted to deal with a biracial adoption?
I didn't know that I was going to put all that in there. Someone said, I'll bet you put some kind of support group chat all the way through the book or something. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And then, of course, I thought, well, why am I not going to do that? So I worked up a kind of Greek chorus of the community down in the living room while Tassie, who's watching the kids, is upstairs. And so these bodiless comments sort of float up, and it doesn't really matter who's saying them. Now, people either are amused and interested, or they find the remarks incredibly tedious and an intrusion upon the narrative. It does. Because it's a bunch of bodiless dialogue, it does take a slightly different form and takes you out a little bit of Tassie's mind and voice and narrative. But it always returns to her because she's the one upstairs listening and watching the kids. And I like the juxtaposition of the grown-ups down there, you know, drinking and saying some things that are actually very serious and important, and sometimes saying stupid things, and sometimes just saying silly things. The juxtaposition with that and the kids upstairs who are of different races and all playing together and having fun, and while the adults hash it out downstairs.
Or as the adults are patting themselves on the back for how pioneering they're being.
Well, some are, right. Some are, yeah.
The New York Times said that you were a rageful writer lurking in the disguise of an endearing one. Do you feel you have rage? And if so, what are you angry at, would you say?
I just don't think I'm in disguise as an endearing one. But that was nice of the New York Times to say. I think this book has a lot of anger in it. I did feel it. I didn't know how many other readers would feel it. I mean, Tassie has a lot of strong feelings that, I mean, I give her a lot of strong feelings to sort of process through the book. And when my editor first read it and called me, she said, "We have reached a whole other level of anger and darkness here, haven't we?" I said, "I guess we have."
Did she say anything about, "Oh, this has to go"?
Well, we talked. There were some problems we had to solve, and we didn't solve all of them. I understood some of the things she wanted me to look at again, and I didn't solve things the way she thought I should, but the way I chose she thought was fine. And I, you know, there were a novel's a hard thing to write. It's very, very hard.
It gets complicated.
It gets complicated in well, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, there I went back and I took her suggestions seriously and tried to problem solve a couple of things. Didn't get everything perfect.
Is that kind of your least favorite part of writing, is that part after the editor says you need to, I mean, you feel you've gotten it off your chest, you know, this is your baby, this is the way you want it to be, and then somebody says, "No, you have to go back now and change things"?
Well, I don't mind if I agree with them. If the editor says, you know, "This part's really a problem," and it strikes a chord in me where I think, yeah, that is a problem, mm-hmm. and I have to work on that. And so I don't mind rewriting. I like rewriting. Writing the first draft is always the hardest. Just that blank piece of paper, filling it in with things, is just the hardest. Rewriting is much, much easier and more fun, I think.
And what are you working on now?
I'm working on some stories.
But you're not going to tell us about those.
No.
Because it would take the bloom off.
It would.
But we'll have to have you back to share them.
We're just going to have to read them, that's all.
That's right.
We'll look forward to that visit. Our guest this hour has been Laurie Moore, short story writer, novelist, and great conversationalist, too.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.